This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, good evening to the folks in the room for joining us and for everyone who will check out a replay of this conversation on the website and through our various social media channels. My name is Stephanie Renee. I'm the curator of photographic memory, and we want to thank the Slot Foundation for being our home and our sponsors, along with Penn's School of Social Policy and Practice, for seeing the vision, if you will, of unearthing some of these outtake photos of my great uncle Maurice Sorel and sharing them with the world at a time where we're having all kinds of conversations, polite or otherwise, about social commentary and the political climate in our nation. These images seek to capture a different kind of narrative, particularly about Black life in America and how people persisted and survived regardless of the popular conversation that was going on about people's place in society and where our nation was headed. And so these Q&A sessions that we have, this is the second of four, that we will engage related to the exhibit are all about giving a different perspective of the importance of archival history. The people that have dedicated part of their personal lives or careers to capturing some aspect of the way we live and share, and have shared it again with the world in really, really significant ways. And so as we were conceptualizing how all of these conversations would come together, I knew that I wanted to have a conversation with tonight's guest, because as an up-and-coming performing artist here in the city of Philadelphia, his radio show was one of the first places that welcomed me as an artist and showed me the value of my voice, however I wanted to use it, and provided a home to be able to network with other people that were like-minded and along a similar path, but also connecting us to the masters here in Philadelphia and in performance genres of all different kinds through his show, The Bridge. So please join me in welcoming J. Michael Harrison of WRTI. Audio Archives. Your radio show has been a beacon for so many people who have not been scared away from the recording industry, for bringing something new and different. So one of the first questions I wanted to ask you is the concept for The Bridge. Where did that come from, and how did you know that this was a way that you wanted to really kind of, dig your toes in, if you will, for your radio presence in Philadelphia?
How much time do we have? So, you know, it's, I feel extremely blessed, very fortunate to have had the opportunity to hear what I thought was some of the most incredible radio ever in anywhere. And growing up in Philadelphia as a young child, hearing Georgie Woods and WDAS, and you know the trajectory that they were on. Later on, Perry Johnson and folks like that. But also hearing the Freedom Sounds and the Point of Jazz at WRTI, the Black Experience in Music at WKDU, and some of the incredible programming that the University of Pennsylvania was offering in shows that actually, and I'll come back to this in a second, shows that started at XPN that ended up at Temple.
Yes.
Like Salt Peanuts and the Library of Jazz, shows like that, as well as Blue Genesis Jazz, as well as the Experimental Radio Project, as well as Diaspora, and so many wonderful programs at XPN. So I was listening to everything and just, you know, immersed. I was attracted to, you know, the radio as well as the television. So you know, I say, especially to young folks all the time, there's nothing new. All of that kind of fueled and helped me put together the radio program that I thought I wanted to present. It's all inclusive of everything that you know, I came up on, but also, you know, just trying to include what was coming or what was yet to come.
Right.
And bring all of that together to bridge from generation to generation.
So for the benefit of people in the audience who may not have had an opportunity to listen into one of your shows, please offer them the intro, if you will, or the tagline of your program so that they have some context for what it is that you play.
So it's funny because people say that to me on the street. You know, people say, wait a minute, what is this? It's the bridge between bebop and hip-hop, an eclectic mix of music and poetry presented from an Is That Jazz perspective. And Is That Jazz was actually the title of the very first show that I did.
Ah.
So I include that in there. And it's also the title of a Gil Scott-Heron
yes.
song. So that's how that comes into that introduction.
And so, you know, you've given us a lot with that, particularly in the idea that commercial radio, however we seek to define it, and this is getting to the point I want to make, has over the last two decades in particular gotten less and less about answering questions for people that might ask, is that jazz? And really attempting to define for people what it is that they want them to call it, how often they want them to hear it, and all of the ways that that comes into play. And you brought this concept and this format to WRTI at a time when technically it was still college radio. So, you know, give us some perspective about the evolution of the station in this time of deregulation and commercial concerns and everything else, about how do we get to from the WRTI of the early years to the WRTI of today?
Well, you know, going back to what became the bridge, it started as Is That Jazz at WPEB,
mm-hmm.
Uplifting fallen humanity through communication,
uh-huh.
first on your FM dial, 88.1.
Yes, West Philadelphia.
Yeah, so that was the genesis of the bridge. Is That Jazz debuted there, and it was a really open format. You actually paid for your time on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the education for me. Transitioning to WRTI, which then was still a 24-hour jazz station.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't morphed into what we know today as classical during the day from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and jazz from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. So again, as a listener, more than anything, I was a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And those transitional, you know, years of it being, you know, primarily with the point, the Freedom Sounds, I heard it, but I wasn't as connected to it. But when it was known more as the point with folks like Aquila,
mm-hmm.
and Ludwig von Tricht and people like that, Jonathan Bay and,
yes.
and Justin and all of those folks that, you know, were doing an excellent job, there was more of a community connection to the radio station. But, you know, radio in general, back then, I'll say, it seemed that there was very much with a WDAS as well and a WHAT, a community aspect to it. So that was definitely part of it, hanging out in Vernon Park and
yeah.
having, you know, RTI broadcasting from Vernon Park.
Yeah.
Those type of activities. There was a strong community connection. Over the years, that point of jazz becomes Jazz 90, Jazz FM, things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And although that theme of jazz, you know, remained and remains, I think the opportunity to experience it in its rawest, purest form on a consistent basis diminished somewhat. Mm-hmm. So my goal coming in was to do what I was doing at WPEB, and that was to try to echo, you know, what came before me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I said earlier, to try to also expose folks that maybe were reluctant to let go of what came before to experience what was coming as well and find a connection and find that it's not the worst thing in the world. But try, you know, and I think the key is exposure.
Yeah.
You know, exposing them to what's out there. And you know, I've had folks tell me that, you know, I listen to your show with my children and we found things on your show that, you know, I didn't know existed. And, you know, I didn't necessarily like rap music, but when I heard, you know, some rappers with some jazz musicians, it sounded different than what I was used to hearing. And right. So me and my kids were digging it together. You know, so that's kind of that goal of what the show is about. And hopefully I'm not going too far off tangent.
But. No. because to me, it all matters. And so, you know, we've talked about the idea of the concept of the show, where the show has aired. Now let's talk about late night and leading into the weekend, because The Bridge is now heard on Friday evenings from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And, you know, you have worked during the day. So even selecting that as the window where you engage listeners in this conversation about Is That Jazz? And pursuing that for years in that time slot, was that intentional? Was it what was available and you've grown into that space? Talk a little bit about occupying that space on the bandwidth.
It started out midnight to 3. Mm-hmm. For the first 6 months, it didn't have a name. And I was polling folks what I should call it. I kind of had in mind The Bridge, but I wanted to hear what other folks would say. And, you know, I would get feedback like, Muse, it should be Muse. And,
you know, I wanted it super artsy, super deep.
You know. and different names. But yeah, it originated, I don't know if you recall, but I'm sure you do. King Britt used to do a show at WRTI, the world-renowned DJ, producer King Britt.
Yes.
Used to do a program called Full Circle.
Yes.
On Wednesday evenings. And he... You know, I think, again, you know, as you probe and you test and you try things, should be recognized, because what he was doing with Full Circle, you would hear, you know, some Miles and you would hear some Sun Ra.
Yeah.
And, but you would also hear some trip hop.
Yes.
You know, and
some things.
You know, and things along those lines. But I used to follow King Britt. Mm-hmm. To bring things back to, you know, the norm at the station. So he was on, I believe, 9 to midnight on Wednesday nights. And this is pre-Bridge.
Right.
And I used to come on at midnight and play the playlist, midnight to 3. Once the station decided that Britt had to go, it was time for a change. And I think, you know, also Britt's, you know, he was so busy that,
yeah,
you know, he couldn't do it anymore. Once that show got phased out, for about a month, I filled in with a Temple student. I did two of the weeks, and he did two of the weeks. Mm-hmm. And mind you, I'm still doing the show at WPEB at that time. So I basically did what I did Is That Jazz at WRTI for those 2 weeks that I was on the air. And Tobias Poole, who's been associated with the radio station forever in different roles, you know, I remember him distinctly calling me up like, yo, what was that? And it was Weather Report. Sweet Night, or I think it was Boogie Woogie Waltz or something like that. And he's like, yo, dude, keep doing it like that. You know, so I'm like, okay, I have him on my side. I see, you know, there's something there. So we made it through that month. And several months later, I get a call from Mike Bailey, who used to do the Philadelphia Jazz Showcase. Mm-hmm. Which was a really cool show featuring Philadelphia artists, interviews, and playing their music. And he was actually doing midnight to 3, Friday night, Saturday morning, and he said he couldn't do it anymore because he was starting a position at the Clef Club that required him to be up early. Mm-hmm. And he asked me, he said, do you want to take over this spot? You can play what you want to play. I'm like, hello. So another name, going back, you know, the history of WRTI, Kim Berry,
yes,
was programming director or music director at that point. And he told me I had to talk to her to make sure it was okay. And I spoke with her, and Kim Berry said to me, I don't have a problem with it. Talk to Tobias about it. So once she said that, I knew it was on and popping.
Yes.
So, you know, I reached out to Tobias and I said, hey, there's an opportunity midnight to 3, Friday night, Saturday morning to do, you know, my own program. He said, do it just like I heard you do it. And that was the start.
Nice.
That's how we get to that point. But as I said, for about 6 months, didn't have a name, but finally I kept coming back to The Bridge. If you look at Sonny Rollins, 1962, he releases The Bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at music and composition, go to James Brown, he's taking you to The Bridge. You know, if you look in our lives, how important bridges are.
Yes.
You know, so I thought this is where it should be. It should be that bridge. So that's nice. How we kind of got to The Bridge.
Nice. Well, see, that brings us back around to the idea of what kind of welcoming space can be created when you have the support of station administration and you have at least a good idea about how you want to present the artistry with the time that you've been given on the air. You know, and there is something to be said for, and I can't stress this enough to those of you who are here, about being invited as an artist who doesn't have the album done yet, but has a good idea about where I'm going with the music or the poetry or whatever else, and coming from a community that is always like, get free. You know, that's a very popular phrase. It's spoken word readings around the city now. It's get free, meaning don't allow yourself to be boxed in by what is commercially successful or any of the other ways that people assume that this genre, if you even fit neatly in one, is supposed to be received by people. Do what you do. And you created that welcome space late night on a Friday in the studio for artists to come in and go, okay, well, I've got this little piece of a poem or this idea of a hook for a song, and no, it's not finished yet, but can I share and get some feedback, encouraging people to call in to the show and into the station and say what they feel when they hear it. And we lament here in Philadelphia now the lack of a wide access to performance stages to even share in that respect. We're not talking about just the people that can fill butts and chairs in one venue. We're talking about your radio show that was getting broadcast out to thousands of people, where folks had incredible access to get that kind of sharing and feedback with an audience. Why was it so important to you to create that safe space for people to experiment?
Well, fundamentally, I'm a fan. So there's a certain level of you know, selfishness associated with that. You know, that's a small part of it. But, you know, again, going back to the late night, you know, option. It wasn't something that I picked. It's not like I had an opportunity to be on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right, right.
All right. But it became available to me. But with that, there's a certain level of freedom and flexibility that comes with that. We were talking earlier, you know, I worked for years in the computer industry, and, you know, I knew people that did not want to work during the daytime hours when all the brass was around, because when you had a thermal control unit failure, and you're losing $1 million every minute that an application is down, you don't necessarily want the vice president over your shoulders, when can we get it up, you know? So a lot of people refrained from that. They knew it was a little easier and laid back during the evenings when not as much brass is around. So having that opportunity late night to do what I was doing, again, it provided that opportunity to welcome in, you know, folks that didn't necessarily look like who was anticipated to be there, sound like who was anticipated to be there, and folks that were on the edge, folks that were trying different things, folks that did not have a record, an album, anything along those lines. This was an opportunity for them to be made available to the listeners. And, you know, I've mentioned to you in the past the reason I got involved with radio was because I was frustrated with what I was hearing and what I was not hearing.
Yeah.
And it was kind of the idea that either you settle for what's there or you try to do something about it. And a door opened at WPEB. That radio station was brought to my attention. And when I became acquainted with that radio station, I saw that as an opportunity.
Yeah.
So I seized that opportunity. But again, you know, the late night option provided a wonderful opportunity for me to invite folks in. Going to a spoken word event, being at a festival, walking down the street, hearing something that's blowing my mind, and I'm thinking if it's blowing my mind, it's going to blow some other minds. So that aspect of it, and then just from the DJ aspect, you know, I used to make pre-radio mixtapes for friends and send them to them at colleges. This was before mixtape was a word, but send them, you know, to them at colleges and universities. And, you know, yo, this is what I've come across recently. Check this out. So trying to create that moment when somebody's driving in their car, in their driveway, at home, in bed, whatever, where they feel like, I can't go to sleep because I have to find out what this song is.
Mm-hmm.
I need to pull over because I need to call him to find out what this is. I'm not getting out of my car in the driveway because I may miss this. I need to find out what this song is. Trying to create that type of vibe for folks as listeners, but also doing that with the guests in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so making you late for work the next day because you were up to 3 a.m, you know, because you had to hear the Twin Poets and Black Ice freestyle together on the air. You had to hear Stephanie Renee, Jill Scott, and Sabella drop Love Rain for the very first time.
In its workshop form.
You know, but listen, devastating. Devastating. Because folks heard that. You know, folks heard that and they're like, oh my gosh, who was that? You know, so those type of moments, hearing Odine Pope, Byard Lancaster, and Prince Lachey playing live on the air in the studio, those type of bright moments, you know, having Roger Smith in the studio doing his Huey Newton imitation when he was portraying Huey.
Yeah.
You know, so those type of moments, I wanted to create those type of moments.
And what you've just described to us is a radio atmosphere that might feel completely foreign to a person who is under the age of 25 in today's society, because once radio got deregulated, it became so much about spins and, you know, projected demographics and about the business side of show business instead of the show. And I wonder, at the time where we're talking about this intense moment of Philadelphia creation, there were also lots of non-traditional venues where folks were going in order to ply their craft. So one of the things, when I think about this period, I think about the Music Room, which was a retail music establishment that was at 13th and Walnut. So first of all, just imagine a record store at 13th and Walnut of today. That was very warehousey, but invited in some really world-class performances, including Gil Scott-Heron with Rich Medina Sabela and Ursula Rucker opening for him.
I have the poster at home.
Yes, I had one until it got water damage. Rich Medina also at the time was leaving legit pharmaceutical sales. I don't want people to misunderstand what I'm saying. He worked for one of the big companies and had opened a retail store with Bobito Garcia at 3rd and Market called Footwork. And so in addition to the t-shirts and high-end sneakers and all of the other kind of urban hip-hop oriented gear and culture, they would clear out space in the middle of the floor and make phone calls to some of the up-and-coming hip-hop and spoken word artists and put them in the middle of the floor and tell them to perform. And so this city at that time was just known for, at any point, at any place that would be imagined as a cool place to be for any number of reasons, shopping, eating, you know, just being among folks, performance could happen in these spaces that was a once-in-a-lifetime place. This is pre-Black Lily and some of the other places that the city became known for. So there was almost a pipeline. You know, we talk negatively about school-to-prison pipeline.
Oh, yeah.
At that time, there was, you know, kind of performance to radio to recording pipeline that was very active here in the city that you were able to capture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, again, frequenting these different locales put me in contact with a lot of folks. And beyond that, because I'm remembering the first time Julie Dexter came through, beyond that, you know, you start to establish a rapport with different artists. So there's a certain level of carte blanche that on a given night, Friday night, they might bring an artist through that's in town. And Julie Dexter, just a gifted artist out of the UK, but been here for probably close to 20 years
singer,
now.
Singer-songwriter who's now based out of Atlanta.
Yeah, she, I remember her coming through with Amun.
Mm-hmm.
But there had to be that night at least 15 other folks in the studio waiting for an opportunity to get on the microphone. And she waited patiently because she had an EP out at the time. She waited patiently to, and it's probably we were doing that midnight to three time frame then. Towards the end of the show, she finally got an opportunity to get on. We played a song again, just devastatingly beautiful, you know, really fun. I mean, this woman can sing, she can play the piano, she's really gifted. And it was, you know, again, just a pleasant jolt of energy, you know, having her come through that night. But there again, there was that relationship in frequenting these different venues of having, connecting, you know, with different artists and these relationships being built, and that level of comfort that they feel like, you know, Big Brother Mike, Brother Mike, whatever the case may be, yo, let's go check out and see what's going on the bridge. And, you know, if nothing else, let's hang out. You know, so it was that type of camaraderie that was there, and a lot of support, you know, a lot of support as well.
Yeah. The concept of the jam session. is something that, you know, sometimes success breeds contempt. Isn't that the popular phrase? And so at this time when Philadelphia's arts community was ripe with talent, overflowing with talent, it also was the push that somebody's going to have to make it relatively big and kind of kick open the door so that these other folks would be able to come through and continue the flow of creativity into the industry at a time when we were sort of struggling for identity, right? Gangster rap was very well established. East Coast versus West Coast and hip hop was very well established. But where R&B was going, we had the era of the girl groups and the era of the guy groups, and then it just kind of, people didn't know what was going on. The scenario that you described with Julie Dexter is almost like a slumber party at the station. Folks would flood into a relatively small space formerly in Anderson Hall, and crowd around these microphones and contribute to one another's compositions, or just listen, just want to be in the room and just be a part of what was happening. Talk about what that was like from your side of the board.
Well, I remember folks bringing food, greens, mac and cheese, out in the lobby area before they even make it in. So there was that activity going on. I remember folks doing hair, you know, while they're waiting for their opportunity to get on the microphone. You know, I remember that, but... I'm going to go to a another night that, again, Jill Scott and Danko.
Uh-huh.
Danko, Jill Scott's cousin, they were there, and I got a call from Steve Coleman, the great saxophonist. And I don't have to say it, because Steve Coleman's call says it. Steve Coleman calls me up, and he says, "Man, I'm just feeling the vibe in there. Can I come down?" And I'm saying, "Bring your saxophone."
Yeah.
So he drives from Allentown to the station because he wanted the energy that was being broadcast, that was emanating out over the airways. Now, of course, he comes that far and he has his saxophone. I'm going to try to get him to play. So while the music is playing, going out over the airways, a lot of introductions are going on behind the scenes and stuff like that. So I remember, you know, introducing him to the poets that were in the house. Of course, nobody knew who Steve Coleman was. He probably had about 15 records out at that point. Nobody knew who he was, but he was the guy with the saxophone.
Right.
So somewhere, there's a tape. There's a tape somewhere of Steve Coleman playing sax behind Jill Scott and Danko.
Amazing once-in-a-lifetime moments that take place when you make room for spirit to enter and for it to do what it do. And so now you are about to continue a celebration of a milestone with this on-air product and your career in radio. So share with our audience where that has taken you and where your vision is for, despite the fact that the times have changed quite a bit around radio and around what the expectations are of on-air personalities and what they can and cannot play, where you sit in this moment and what the future holds.
Well, last month, June, represented the start of the 25th year in radio. So it's 25 years. You know, it's amazing to me to see things develop the way they've developed. Because, you know, this wasn't something that I started for money.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it was out of frustration. Right. I was paying to do it.
Yeah.
But again, looking back at everything that had came before me, there was a lot of respect and appreciation for what came before me. So going on the air I was fueled by so many wonderful, wonderful broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I listen to everything coming up, AM, FM, white, black, Latino. I was listening to every radio station that you could imagine because I just loved music.
Yeah.
That was at the core of the whole thing.
Right.
You know, I loved music. You know, I grew up with television and radio, and I knew the significance of radio connecting to television. So 25 years in, I've been afforded the opportunity to play the role of mentor to interns. Mm-hmm. And help them understand that there's a lot that came before them.
Yeah.
It didn't start with them.
Right.
And try to have that integrity and respect for what comes before you, but to provide an opportunity and blessed for the opportunity to help guide them on their path. Mm-hmm. 25 years in, I couldn't have imagined 25 years ago that I would be working solely at
he's,
WRTI.
He's Caribbean in blood. He got many, many jobs over the years.
You know. So, you know, I mean, I think we were chatting. I don't even know how I was doing. I mean, there was times, and I'm talking as recent, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, there was times that I would work 4 jobs in a 27-hour period.
I can't.
You know, from starting, you know, 8 o'clock on Friday to 3:30, 4 o'clock at 7:30 teaching a broadcast journalism class, finishing that up, walking down the hall and doing the bridge from 10 to 2, mm-hmm. and getting up at 7 the next morning to teach a 3-hour class at Haverford High School. So in about 27 hours, that was 4 jobs. I don't know how the hell I was doing that.
That was youth.
but part of it was, I think, it allowed me to do what I was doing on Friday nights.
Yeah.
You know, so it was, you just did whatever else you had to do and try to balance it out. So 25 years later, to be in a position where the only job I go into is a radio station is scary,
yeah,
in many respects. To do things that I'm able to do now that, you know, and again, it's shout outs to WRTI because there's been a lot of folks that believe in what I do.
Yeah.
You know, from Mike Bailey, Kim Barry, Tobias, you know, all of these folks, Bill Clark, who was the programming director, you know, early on. He's the first one to put me really on the air at WRTI. Mm-hmm. All of those folks over the years who continue to believe in what I do, there's a lot of love.
Yeah.
A lot of love. So the things that I'm able to do now, you know, I was speaking of Steve Coleman, I mean, we're trying to set up a Facebook Live session with him next week. Mm-hmm. A very young artist, Emmanuel Wilkins, is coming in to do a Facebook Live session soon as well. And to see him grow, I mean, 10 years ago, I mean, he's about to finish up at Juilliard.
Uh-huh.
But 10 years ago, he and several other young musicians were recording, it's on Facebook, you can watch it now, a version of Red Clay. Mm-hmm. You know, he couldn't have been more than like 12, 13 tops. And to see him now performing as a leader, about to, you know, finish up at Juilliard, these are incredible bright moments. But again, to be able to look at doing a Facebook Live session to spearhead the View House initiative at WRTI, mm-hmm. to play a role in establishing a jazz education initiative at WRTI, to hold down the bridge for 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting. So there's a lot, you know, I think there's a lot to come. I think that I really see, you know, we have a performance space, which I showed you at the mm-hmm. station,
mm-hmm.
and we're really upgrading and adding to that so that we can do additional things. We're doing a lot of things with the university. Terrell Stafford, who does a great job.
Yes.
Over
Jazz
at the Boyer
Orchestra
School.
Philadelphia.
Yeah. And the Boyer School of Music, as an educator, started a series called the Rite of Swing Jazz Cafe, which is done right on campus, mm-hmm. you know, and every Thursday during the semester, there's a performance, and it's a high level performance. And we record that. We'll probably be filming some of that in the future. So I think it's really a great time at the station, a really wonderful, you know, amount of activity and initiatives and vision, which is one of my favorite words. A lot of that is happening. And, you know, Bill Johnson, who's running things at the station right now, you know, a lot of that you can attribute to, you know, to him and wanting to take the station to another level, to be a part of that, to be immersed in this activity. Again, I feel really blessed. So there's some really cool stuff where recording, you know, doing recording projects, CDs, mm-hmm. you know, starting to do that and hope to do one with the great Jimmy Merritt in the future. It's just so much that's happening.
Well, you know, I want to ask one more question, and then we'll open it up for the audience to ask questions as well. And for the benefit of the recording, I'll translate on the microphone so that we can capture what you all are asking. But in this time where we have seen a vast evolution of how people experience music,
mm-hmm.
How do you think algorithms and streaming services will impact people's desire to be adventurous, to seek out music that they haven't heard before, and perhaps realize that they're not well-versed enough to travel these roads with so much material if we're going back years and looking for it? You got to know the names to program into streaming services in order for you to go down a path that you want to listen to. And so the role of the radio DJ, the role of experimental programming, to me, is something essential that we keep alive in our society. But what are your thoughts about the way that the average person now experiences music and how that will impact what we have available to us another 25 years from now?
Well, I think it's up to us to be cognizant of the world and the way it's changing. You know, in the same way, it's important, I think, for us that are not necessarily so young anymore to not wait for the younger folks to find it, but to help them find it. You know, I think we have to be the ambassadors. While we are the ambassadors, I think we can help develop and cultivate a core cadre of young ambassadors as well.
Yeah.
Because when I say, yo, you should check this out, a lot of young folks are going to say, okay, old head. But when one of their peers says, yo, that's dope, check it out, they may say, really?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you can enlist the help of young folks that are attuned and interested and open-minded and want it and seek it,
yeah.
If you can bring them into your world, that can make a difference. I think it's also the responsibility of radio to recognize that it is, again, a changing world, and not everybody has a radio. Not even their car may
right.
have a radio.
That's real.
So radio has to exist on multiple platforms.
Yes.
So you have to embrace the digital, you know, frontier. So doing Facebook Live, mm-hmm. utilizing your website, creating a presence in the cyber world and not just relying on analog radio per se, yeah. I think is essential to the success of radio. But one of the reasons that I wanted to start an education program at the radio station was that exposure component. Yeah. In the same way that a child goes to school, goes on school trips to the Franklin Institute, the Academy of Natural Sciences, mm-hmm. the zoo, mm-hmm. The Philadelphia Museum of Art, you know, the Jewish Museum, the mm-hmm. African American Museum, and all of these staple signature locations in Philadelphia. Tasty Cake, you know. I still remember going to Tasty Cake as a kid. Well, it should be on the school's radars to say, okay, I see there's an option to go to this radio station. And they'll give us a tour of the radio station, and they'll talk a little bit about jazz history. And we'll see a jazz performance at the radio station. Maybe we should try to factor that in. Mm-hmm. Maybe at our third grade level, we'll make that a trip for the third graders every year. Whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But I think we have to open ourselves up to the world and recognize that if we want people to continue to listen to the music that we're playing, we have to let them know that it's there.
Yeah.
Every day you have Temple students that walk past our building and have no idea that there's a radio station upstairs in that building. Mm-hmm. Probably some of them that come into that building and stop at other floors have no idea that there's a radio station in that building. And I hear it from my interns.
Yeah.
You know, they had no idea that this radio station existed. 17,000 students on the campus of Temple University that live there, most of them do not know. Many of them music students, and they don't know that that radio station is there. So it's our responsibility to make them know
yeah.
that we are here. So we have to develop and find ways to educate them.
Yeah, and make them fans. At least make them curious.
Expose them.
Yes.
So, yeah, okay. So if I asked you as a student at Temple University or a student at some charter school or a student at wherever, you know, have you heard of any jazz musicians? And you maybe say Miles Davis or you say Louis Armstrong. Isn't Nas's dad a jazz musician? You know, it's something along those lines. Well, you know, hopefully we can put you in a position where you can say, well, not only Miles and Pops, but yeah, that guy Charlie Parker, he was kind of instrumental in right. the way things were moving, you know. And I heard in Philadelphia, John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner, you know, but also we're doing a lot now and Christian McBride, you know. I remember when we went to WRTI, they told us to check out Jazz Night in America on NPR and Philadelphia's own Christian, you know, so to start to make those connections.
Yeah.
And again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to, you know, be at South, you know, every Friday or Saturday. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to checking out the Ars Nova website to see what's, you know, happening locally or, you know, listen to The Bridge on a consistent basis,
right.
but to maybe take their game up to another level. And when they hear, you know, somebody, they may be able to connect with them. And then later on, maybe they start to explore because they want their children to know that there's this music called jazz, America's music, and they want to expose them to it. And as they continue to search and explore, okay, wow, so you've got rappers that have done things with jazz musicians. Let me check some of that out.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I rap a little bit. Maybe I'll get with a saxophonist or a trumpet. You know, and they start to, you know, expand their horizon. So that's kind of the goal.
Well, as one of the baby birds that you kicked out of the nest by inviting me to guest DJ on the program, and that was the beginning of me coming back to Penn's campus, to WQHS, the student station, and asking about free slots, and growing with that until it became time prohibitive, as you mentioned, middle of the day. And turning that into the Soul Sanctuary Radio podcast that's now been operating for the last 15 years, which is just mind-blowing to me. Thank you for making your show a welcome space, not only for the performance of the music, but for an appreciation, and for me in particular, knowing that I had a responsibility to not leave you as the only one on the field that was trying to bring this music to an audience and finding a vehicle that fit in my schedule and my artistic framework to help extend the conversation. And if we have more people that are continuing to add to it in that way, the world is going to be a much better place.
Yeah, well, you know, again, it blew my mind when I heard you start pursuing the radio thing and the fact, you know, that I played a role in that. It makes me very proud in many respects because you've done a great job. And I think you have to be complimented on your efforts. But, you know, again, that was just really interesting for me to hear. Oh, Stephanie's doing radio? What? What?
Wait, and this is after he was like, why aren't you doing radio? So, you know, I want people to understand that this wasn't, I just came to this Eureka on my own.
So, no, but it's just wonderful to see that. But, you know, there's been so many folks that have been connected to the show one way or another that have gone on to do their thing. And, you know, again, I mean, what more can I say than being blessed to be put in a position, you know, to help? I think that's part of the reason that we are here.
Yeah.
It's to help others.
Yes.
You know, and to be in that position to help others on their journey, which I've been, you know, blessed to do as an educator, you know, on many levels, but definitely with the radio side of things, and putting folks in the position to be on the air and be heard. That is remarkable for me. But, you know, I want to compliment you on this wonderful, you know, exhibition that you have here as well.
Well, thank you. Well, the conversation is about archives. And so, however you are moved, as those of you here in the audience, think about what do you have possession of that helps to tell a story, and perhaps a story that people have not had access to because it's been personal to you, because it's been in your own collection, but giving it a larger audience can be that next step in creating the next magnum opus for the world, and that we can never predict when it happens, but by sharing, we increase the opportunity for that. That's what this is all about. And so, you know, J. Michael Harrison is here tonight representing the audio archival piece of that, and all the ways that he's contributed to it. But if any of you have any questions about anything that we talked about now, please feel free to share. Folks are just grinning and nodding. Yes.
Well, you know, I was hoping that I've been once again blessed with three incredible children, and I was hoping that one of them might be able to make it tonight. One of them works for the IRS. Another one works for hospitals. My son is home from college, but he's working, you know, making the money, so they couldn't be here tonight. But I bring them up because there was a phone call that I used to make from the radio station right before, you know, I went on air, and that was to have them to push the button on the tape. So for a long time, they were pushing a button, but I used to also run 120-minute cassettes,
yes,
in two wells to capture 4 hours of programming. So I recorded pretty consistently from about 1993 to about 2010. So a lot of those shows are recorded on some medium, mostly cassette tape. There's a mini disc.
I was going to say, so the digitizing process for any of this stuff that, you know, came prior to being able to record directly to disc is a major undertaking. So for anybody listening on the recording who might have some extra time, our retirees and folks who need meaningful internships, there are a lot of audio archivists could use some assistance because you got to record them in real time, and that is extremely time consuming.
You can't rip a cassette.
Yeah.
So now does RTI record?
Yeah, well, even then the FCC mandates that every second of every day has to be recorded. So back then it was on cassette. They had a logger that recorded on cassette. Now it's done digitally.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what archive is with the station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's still, you know, in the world of archiving, whether we're talking about radio or television, how long folks keep them. It's sort of like your how long you keep records for the IRS, right? You've got the 7-year window that it's mandatory. Once you reach mandatory archiving for the FCC, then all bets are off. And there are a number of people who have done a lot of doctoral research on public television programs, for instance, who find that literally a lot of these stations got to a window where everything was being recorded on like beta or 2-inch tape, and they tossed them. I mean, you know, just massive amounts of these archives have been lost to history. And so the idea of how we're preserving now, how long we're preserving it, and what the long-term plan is for preserving it for future generations has to be a conversation that we engage in actively.
So I was fortunate enough to record pretty much, I would say, in that period, I recorded probably 80-85% of the shows. So I still have a lot of that content, and the goal is to ultimately transfer it. I was telling Stephanie recently that I just randomly pulled out some tapes that I hadn't listened to, and it was mind-boggling because I hadn't heard some of this stuff for, you know, 15 years, and some of the interview footage and just some of the music, you know, revisiting some of the music that I haven't played for a long time. It's just really interesting to revisit it.
Yeah, and I want to also emphasize for the benefit of everyone, redundancy. We mentioned this during the Real Black Q&A on opening night, but it's not enough to digitize it once. You've got to digitize it and then copy it in like 3 or 4 different places and store them in different places just in case there's a mechanical failure, just in case there's an act of God that destroys something. You know, these hard drives are getting better and better, but they still fail at some point. So the redundancy of digitizing this material and having it in several different places just in case something happens so that we can go back and retrieve it and share it again becomes really, really important. As someone who spent some time overseas working in Singapore and came back, and you know, I was doing the podcast while I was away, but I came back and was in the midst of putting a podcast together and had the hard drive where all of the bootleg songs that I downloaded, remixes, you know, that you couldn't buy them. These were like custom remixes and all kinds. Literally, I watched as I was walking back in the room, the hard drive take a nosedive off of my desk and then just hear click, 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 click. So I still have it because I still hope, but you know, for an artist, for you to tell me that it's going to cost me $1,000 for you to open the thing up, and that's not guaranteeing me that you can fix it. That's just to open it up in a clean room so that you can work with the mechanics of the drive and see if it's salvageable. That was just not something that was available. So I have it wrapped up in bubble wrap for the one day where I have all kinds of disposable income and can try and retrieve
you have to play to win.
Some of that stuff. Exactly.